You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Maggie Kleiss. Maggie is a therapist and consultant with her own practice in Birmingham, Alabama. She is a certified eating disorder specialist and is extremely trained in several therapeutic modalities and is a trained interventionist. She is a national presenter on the topics of eating disorders, autism, and addiction. She is committed to staying up to date with current research and best practices, combining this knowledge with empathy and compassion to best meet the needs of her clients. In this episode, we dive even deeper into the intersection of eating disorders and autism, which, by the way, has a co-occurrence rate of over 25%. And I am sure you will find this episode of the show so fascinating. And with that, I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, hello, Maggie. How are you today?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing so well. It's really like a very spring day here. It's warm. It's sunny. I'm in Connecticut, so it's rare that we get warm, sunny days at this time of year. Where are you located at the moment?
So I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and we're also in a very springy day. So enjoying this before it gets to the, like, you know, 90 humid weather that we get in a couple of
That sounds like a lot. Yeah, the really hot, humid weather. When does that show up for you guys typically?
Usually starting in May.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, enjoy this month.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I am so excited to speak with you today. I especially am excited about the topic because it seems to just keep coming up in my practice and with my listeners that there is a co-occurrence between eating disorders and autism. And before we dive into that, I want to hear more about you, more about your story, and then we can talk more in detail about that co-occurrence. But to start, I'd love if you could please share a little bit about your background and what inspired you to become a therapist who specializes in eating disorders.
Yeah. So I'm recovered myself. And so that was a little bit about what drew me to initially be interested in treating eating disorders. I think the other interesting piece that I didn't know I would have kind of this interest in kind of the overlap of autism and eating disorders. But right out of undergrad, my first job was actually working at a facility that served autistic children and adults. And so that was my first experience. And I didn't know until more recently how that would kind of influence me and my areas of interest. So I started off there. Then after grad school, I did some work at an addiction-specific treatment facility and then moved to eating disorder facility and was clinical director there and then have been in private practice for the past 7 years now.
Wow. Okay. So when you were working with folks who are autistic, did you see any of the co-occurrence with eating disorders when you were working with them as their therapist?
At that time, I wasn't a therapist. I was just like support staff. And so these were individuals that had fairly high needs in multiple different areas. And so a lot of the eating kind of challenges that were seen were just more preferences for very specific foods in more limited variety. So there wasn't at that time even like a whole ton of like, oh, it rings as familiar. I don't think that occurred for me until, you know, later on in practicing as a therapist and seeing it a lot more and seeing the overlaps. And then I have a child who's autistic. And so especially at that point, like really doing a bunch of research and kind of like, oh my gosh, like this is very familiar personally. This is very familiar for what I see in working with my clients. And so it was really just kind of this rabbit hole moment of there are so many overlaps and why isn't this talked about more or researched more? It's just really this huge gap in our field, I think.
So was that rabbit hole kind of motivated by trying to find answers for your, did you say it was your son who has autism?
My daughter.
Your daughter. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think initially I was working with some autistic clients and just feeling like there was a piece that was missing. Like there was something that wasn't working as well. I didn't feel like I was serving some of my clients to the best of my ability. And so I started having some interest at that point. And then later on, my daughter was diagnosed and then really kind of deep diving in even more and really seeing that connection.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So there were almost a few elements, like what you were seeing in your own practice, what you had going on at home brought you to this place of really seeing that link between individuals who are autistic and the co-occurrence of eating disorders. Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. It's actually really fascinating. I recently read that 25% of folks with anorexia meet the criteria for autism. And I would love if you could perhaps explain, if you know, what the root of that high rate of co-occurrence might be. Do you know, like, or have an explanation for why that co-occurrence exists?
Yeah, it's really high. And even that percentage goes up to, when you're looking at inpatient samples, up to 37% of those with anorexia. So it's higher in those samples. And then, you know, ARFID's really high as well. In some studies, that's up to 33%. A lot of times that's more 12 to 13%. But in all of those, like what we're seeing is there's just a lot of shared traits. And there's this concept, it's called shared endophenotypes. So it's these aspects of both autism and anorexia where they have some shared traits and they're thought to be more biological in nature. But they're things that we can see, that we can test for, they're observed. And so these endophenotypes are kind of this link between genetic kind of explanation and what we're seeing trait-wise. And so there's lots of overlaps there. So biologically, there's lots of overlaps. When you're looking at some of the neurocognitive traits, you know, in both anorexia and with autism, what you see for both is superiority and detailed focus processing. So that would be one trait. In both, you're seeing difficulties with set shifting. That would be another. Mm-hmm. There tends to be a little bit more of the insistence on sameness and rigidity that go with mm-hmm. both. And so there's lots of these kind of neurocognitive traits that overlap. And then we know there is a genetic component. So if you're looking at families, for those where there is someone who has anorexia, there is a higher likelihood that someone else in the family is going to be autistic. So some overlaps there. And then with ARFID, what you're seeing too is there is a gene that's the ZSWIM6 gene that's been identified as a neurodevelopmental gene that connects kind of both ARFID and autism. It's connected with both of those.
Wow. Okay. So thank you for expanding on that a little bit. So there's a lot of genetic connections, it sounds like, between this co-occurrence, which I was not aware of.
Yeah. So there's the genetic piece. And then I think the other aspect of it too is when you talk about like the high co-occurrence rates, one of the arguments that some people will try to make is, well, it's not really that we have a higher instance of anorexia with autistic individuals. It's more that it's the results of starvation from anorexia that are causing changes in the brain that are then resulting in some of these autistic traits. And research is just across the board showing like that's not the case, like that these traits really predate the eating disorder and are predisposing an individual to the development of an eating disorder. So that, you know, if someone is starting to, you know, restrict their food intake and develop food rules because of the autistic traits, they're more likely to kind of like have those specific rules and it's going to be harder for them to shift out of them. And so it just becomes more entrenched. And so it's really some of those traits that are predisposing the individual to the eating disorder.
Okay. I really like how you made that distinction that it's not the eating disorder causing these traits. It's actually the autism that predates the eating disorder and brings out those behaviors with food.
It makes an easier kind of pathway to connect to that. And then, you know, looking at two kind of the functions of the eating disorder, you know, when you think about some of the results of the restriction, right, like that can help with some of the sensory sensitivity that autistic individuals, especially with some of those hypersensitivities, it will make that a little quieter in the brain. Or it's a method of social connection, because unfortunately, in our, you know, very diet obsessed culture, if someone's looking to build a social connection, being able to talk about diet or I don't like my body or weight loss, it is an easy way to do that. You know, you can connect to almost anyone around that. And again, that's unfortunate, but that's the culture that we're in right now.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is the autistic individuals are likely to turn to the eating disorder to cope for some of the common challenges folks with autism have. So the social challenges, you know, the eating disorder helps to cope with that because it gives you something more to relate to other people to talk about. And then you were also mentioning making the sensory overload a little less overwhelming with food, at least.
Yes, yes. And because a lot of times autistic individuals with eating disorders are experiencing their eating disorder in a slightly different way. And so there's different motivators for engagement in the behavior. Again, not all the time, but frequently what we're seeing in research and what I'll see in my practice is that is the case. And so it's important to kind of distinguish what functions are the behavior serving. So, you know, another one, so for autistic individuals having different special interests. So a special interest in numbers across the board, but then when we're looking at eating disorders, right, that could manifest as high focus on calories or the number on the scale, or if someone has a special interest in kind of like environmental issues, that might manifest more as moving into like veganism and then some orthorexic tendencies. And so there's lots of areas where these overlap, and it's not always what it looks like on the surface. A lot of times, you know, what my clients will talk about is this isn't an eating disorder behavior for me, like this is related to my autism. And that's a lot of the work in recovery of teasing apart what's related to the eating disorder and what's related to the autism, because we're not treating the autism, right? We're treating the eating disorder. And so we don't want to treat things that are associated with the autism.
Yes, that makes sense. And that sounds, from my perspective, really difficult to do, like having to manage autism and an eating disorder and recognize that some of these thoughts that look disordered are actually autistic traits and autistic behaviors, and then navigating that in your mind, and then also navigating that in the outside world where most treatment providers have no idea how to approach this, like, distinction and this difference.
Yeah. And that's a lot of times where clients are struggling is, you know, especially in treatment settings, if they go to treatment and, you know, they didn't complete a meal and it's automatically assumed it's because it's an eating disorder behavior. It was a fear food. They didn't want to gain weight, when in reality it was, hey, it was like sensory overload at that meal. And I just kind of went to shut down and I couldn't do it. And so then providers are trying to address, you know, what looks like eating disorder behavior and missing how they can actually support the client better, which is addressing some of the sensory overload piece. So, I mean, I think that's just one example where it's important for that to be a continual discussion. It's not a one-time, hey, what parts of these are, you know, part of the eating disorder and what are related to the autism? It's continually assessing throughout treatment. Does this still feel like this is related to the eating disorder, or does this feel a little bit different at this point?
Mm-hmm. And is that difficult to sometimes clearly know if an individual who is autistic is going through treatment? Is there confusion ever on, like, is this really an eating disorder thing or an autistic behavior?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially thinking about like the eating disorder is still the eating disorder. And so a lot of times there is that ambivalence around recovery, or there is a desire to kind of keep part of the eating disorder. And so I've had lots of clients who initially like, nope, that's part of my autism, like not touching that. And then as treatment progresses, being able to be like, hey, I actually think this might be somewhat rooted in my eating disorder. And so, you know, having the ability to continually have that dialogue where it's not you know, the provider saying, nope, this is the eating disorder. Like you're saying, it's autism, this is the eating disorder, but it being really collaborative and more just holding curiosity around that.
Yeah, that definitely requires an open conversation. Absolutely. And I feel like a lot of honesty on the individual's part to just continuously check in and say, like, is my eating disorder trying to take over here and stay prevalent, you know, stay strong in the guise of the autism, or is it actually my autism speaking?
Right, right.
Wow, that's really fascinating. You mentioned the example of sensory overload might be a reason why someone's not eating. It can be really confused, and it can really confuse providers, like in a treatment setting. Do you have other examples of how that mistake could look like, what that could look like in the treatment setting?
Yeah, so a lot of times autistic clients with eating disorders, one of the drivers is not so much shape and weight, right? Like it's a part of it, but not one of the primary drivers. And, you know, another thing related to kind of sensory experience might be weight gain. And so the individual might be talking about, I don't like the fact that I've gained weight. And it's not from an appearance standpoint. It's not, I don't like that I've gained weight and I don't like the way that I look. It's sensory, like I don't like the way that that feels on my body. And so then again, if the provider is coming at it from addressing body image, it's missing the mark. That's not what's going on there.
That's such an interesting perspective. And I've heard that before in my practice. It's not necessarily look and appearance. It's how the weight feels on my body or how this change in my body feels. How do you support someone who's experiencing that typically?
I think it's really important that we expand the treatment team. So, you know, definitely getting an occupational therapist on board to work more specifically with some of those sensory sensitivities or sensory needs. I think the other aspect is, you know, how do we build up some of that distress tolerance of tolerating those sensations that are really uncomfortable and being able to give voice to them and name that. It's also looking at making overall accommodations. So for a neurotypical client with an eating disorder, if it's like, hey, they're wearing baggy clothing, we might say, well, hey, is that a body avoidance behavior? Are you trying to avoid connecting with your body or seeing your body? And would encourage against that, right? Like, well, could we challenge it by wearing something that is a little bit more form-fitting or something that you really enjoy wearing? Whereas for an autistic client, it might be exploring like, hey, if we wear baggier stuff, like, does that feel better? Are there other sensory inputs that would feel more calming to kind of counteract the distress that's felt related to the shift in weight?
And does that over time help decrease on average the distress in that person's body they feel with the sensory overload? Or is it a constant like needing to cope with that?
I think it can show up in different ways. So I think the distress around like what any like weight gain might feel like, that typically, at least what I've seen anecdotally, goes away, but it's not the sensory piece in general.
Okay, got it. So the sensory challenges that an autistic individual might experience, that doesn't disappear. You're not healing or getting rid of that. It is right. The sensory experience of having a different body or even a larger body that can become easier to live with and experience.
Right.
Okay. Awesome. Interesting. I find this to be pretty, at least helpful for me as someone who seems to see this co-occurrence a lot in the space that I'm working in. One thing that comes up, I think, is you also already mentioned it, like challenges with treatment, right? Mm-hmm. And so could you please expand upon some of the unique challenges that autistic individuals experience when seeking treatment for an eating disorder?
Hello, listeners. It is that time of year again. That's right. We're opening the doors to my global eating disorder recovery community, the Recovery Collective, on May 18th. And we would love to have you join us. Curious to know what it's like inside? Here's what some of our current members are saying.
My favorite part about the Recovery Collective is that as of joining about a year ago, I finally realized how important it is to have a community in recovery.
It was definitely a turning point for me to finally talk to someone who's understanding.
The people in the Recovery Collective are some of the most lovely, supportive people I've ever met.
If you're thinking about joining the Recovery Collective, I have two words to say to you. Do it. Literally just give it a chance. I think you will be surprised in the most wonderful way.
Make the jump and join. It's honestly one of the best things I ever did, and I've made some of my best friends from around the world.
It's a safe place for me. I know I can say anything and never get judged for it. And I feel that we all truly care about each other.
Well, there you have it. Our members have spoken. And I might be a little biased, but I think our community is pretty great too. For more information, check out the link in the show notes and make sure you sign up for the waiting list so you can be the first to join our community on May 18th.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big issues is, so if an individual is autistic and it's not diagnosed, a lot of times what will happen for that individual is they will go to treatment and then it's they're not making progress fast enough, they're not engaging, and they end up getting discharged early, asked to leave, you know, insurance cuts, fill in the blank. And so without the diagnosis, that's the issue. But then on the other hand, if we have the diagnosis, then there's a lot of treatment providers or treatment facilities that are like, hey, like, we can't manage that. Right. And so even finding a provider or finding a treatment center that can really work well with these clients is very challenging for them. Mm-hmm. I think the other aspect, too, that unfortunately a lot of our clients face is that, you know, they will go to a provider and it's like, well, let's put the autism on the back burner. Like, we're just going to work on the eating disorder right now. And you can't do that. Like, the autism is a part of that individual's identity and it interacts a lot with the eating disorder. And so you can't just ask an individual to like set aside part of their identity so that, hey, we can treat this eating disorder in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And when we're looking overall at outcomes, they tend to be worse for autistic individuals. And I think that's, you know, mostly due to the fact we're not providing treatment that is specific to their needs. So I think there's the access of care piece. It's the difficulties in how do we shift how we might do treatment for a neurotypical individual. And then I think there's also difficulties that are inherent, like especially if we talk about going somewhere for treatment. So for higher levels of care, where they might be having to contend with a bunch of unknowns. They aren't getting as much say as food. So it's not, you know, that's another issue that's often brought up is they're asked to eat food that is sensory related. It wasn't part of their eating disorder. And so, you know, they're asked to eat food that's really, really uncomfortable for them in a way that's not related to the eating disorder. Or again, like noise level or lots of participation in group, unfamiliar people. When we think about like schedule, like they're not in control of it. And so there's tons of aspects of just going to treatment where it's a huge added stressor. And going to treatment for anyone is hard in and of itself. And so when we're adding all these other components, it just makes it really, really overwhelming.
That sounds extra difficult. Like treatment in itself is hard. Yes. And then adding on this layer of difficulty and complications that are kind of unforeseen by the providers, because that's not necessarily what they're specializing in, you know, to help, it can just lead to maybe, I'm assuming, a very stressful experience. And would you say typically, I don't even know what the right word to say here is, but would you say that it's typically an unsuccessful experience when someone with autism goes to treatment and it's not known or considered or taken into consideration?
Yes, if it's either like put on the back burner, just kind of ignored, or if it hasn't been diagnosed, then I'd have not seen a successful outcome. When and there's, you know, definitely experiences that individuals have where it can be really life-changing, especially if it's someone who has not been diagnosed previously. And then in treatment, you know, that's when they ended up being diagnosed, where it's like this kind of relief of, well, this explains a lot for me. And it puts things in context, and then treatment's able to be altered in a way that's more supportive. So I think it has the ability when providers are able to, you know, speak to both sides, to be a very powerful experience. So it's just making sure that whether it's the provider or whether it's the treatment facility, that there is experience in that area. So it's not the experience of, well, we'll just address this later.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You bring up the diagnosis element of autism. And I've heard so much about how, you know, there's maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but there seems to be a wave of like adult female identifying women who are now being diagnosed. I don't know if that's the right term, with autism. And can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. There's a couple of things with that. So one is with the shift to the DSM-5, you know, that occurred a while back, autism no longer had to be diagnosed in childhood. So you could have adults who were being diagnosed later on. The traits still had to be present early on, but the diagnosis could occur at any age. So one, it opened up that possibility. Two, there is this concept of kind of the female phenotype related to autism, where autistic females have a slightly different expression of their autism. And, you know, part of this, it leads to difficulties with diagnosis. So when you look at kind of like the gold standard measure that's used for diagnosis, the ADOS-2, there was a study and they took a known autistic sample. So individuals who had been diagnosed, and they gave it to males and they gave it to females. And for the males, it identified like, yes, they scored above cutoff, you know, close to 100% of the time. For females, it was catching about 76% of them. So, you know, there were, you know, close to 25% of females where the gold standard wasn't flagging these autistic traits. And so a lot of the measures that have been created were created around males. And then for females too, they don't evidence as much apparent social difficulty overall. So you see a lot more camouflaging behavior. And there's some, again, that can, you know, they're starting to see brain differences that kind of support this. So when you're looking at autistic females, autistic males, some brain differences there that are only found in autistic individuals, not in neurotypical individuals, that can kind of explain some of that. But even if you look at like young kids, if you look at like young girls on a playground, what you'll see is they will frequently jump from group to group. And that's part of the camouflaging strategy of, if I'm not with the same group for too long, they're not going to pick up on these things. And so it's a way to protect, or they will kind of identify traits of someone that they see as more socially successful and adapt some of those traits. So some of the social difficulties aren't as apparent. And so especially early on, they're not being seen for assessment. And so, you know, all of that's going on. And then now I think it's with TikTok, there's a lot on TikTok is why I specifically referenced that. But there's a lot more information about kind of life as an autistic female. And so I think a lot of individuals are like, oh, wait, I can relate to that. And then they might pursue diagnosis, or adults who, you know, their children are diagnosed. And then it's like, oh, wait, like I'm identifying with a lot of these traits myself. And then they pursue diagnosis.
Okay. Interesting. I think that makes sense. Like someone might fly under the radar for a long time if they are taking on like socially acceptable, like personality traits and behaviors, like to kind of blend in a little bit more. I think that makes a lot of sense because I've seen that. I think I know a handful of women in their 30s by now who are just now exploring this diagnosis.
Yeah. And I think oftentimes like a challenging process to undergo diagnosis, but a lot of times it's a relief because again, it's an explanation for, you know, I've felt different my whole life, but I can't explain why. I think the other aspect where there's still issues, and this is kind of across the board, but a lot of times there is sort of misdiagnosis that happens with ADHD, where an ADHD diagnosis will be given when really it's actually an autism diagnosis would be more fitting, or there's both that are occurring at the same time. And I think a lot of that boils down to stigma, right? Like it's a lot easier to say like, hey, you know, I think you have traits that are related to ADHD versus I think you have autistic traits. And so it's important too, if there's an ADHD diagnosis and an eating disorder diagnosis on board, that autism at least be, you know, considered and looked at. And then there's also a big move towards self-diagnosis. So not seeking out formal diagnosis, but an individual being able to say like, I have these traits and, you know, I'm autistic. Because again, like we're not treating autism. So sometimes people like having like a formal diagnosis and that feels validating, but it's equally as valid for someone to diagnose themselves. People have different views on what fits best for them.
That's really empowering to hear that somebody can just move forward, like claiming that for their own, and they don't have to go through the arduous diagnostic process to accept that as a reality for themselves. I feel like many people would feel like they're not allowed to do that for some reason, like they need a doctor or a specialist to make that for them. But I know, like when I had my eating disorder, I diagnosed myself, right? So it's like, you know, I can see how that would be really empowering.
Absolutely. And I think too, kind of this idea of self-diagnosis moved towards, you know, there's a lot of how autism is approached that's very much like medical model and deficits based, and being able to look at it more from like identifying the strengths that are related to autism and it not being so medicalized, but just differences in the human brain, just like there's tons of different variations that are more supportive of that as well.
That is a really cool perspective. I like that a lot. You mentioned the phrase, we're not treating the autism, I think twice. And I get what you're saying, but I'd love for you to expand on that through like an eating disorder recovery lens, because I think that's very related to the topic today.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think when we have someone who's looking at recovery from an eating disorder, we're talking about like recovered, like we can get to the point where we're recovered, you know, this isn't a thing anymore, right? And so we're holding like, we're seeking recovery in this area. There are things related to this that we're going to change that aren't going to be part of your life anymore. And so I think the tendency is to think about, well, let's do that over here with autism. And that's not the case. Like there's nothing that needs to be treated over there. Again, that's coming from that more medical model of there's a problem and autistic individuals need to look more neurotypical. And that's just not true. So when I say like, we're not treating the autism, it's because there's nothing there that needs to be treated. So, you know, someone might have, let's say they are struggling, one of their needs is they're struggling to connect socially. And that's something that they want. They want more friendships, but they struggle to know how to initiate or to keep those friendships. And then we're looking at the eating disorder, and that's where the eating disorder came in of, hey, well, I can talk about, you know, diet, or I have friends with now that I can go exercise with. So, you know, one of the areas to address might be like some interpersonal skills so that the individual feels more confident in having social connections outside of topics related to the eating disorder. So there still might be things that are associated or, you know, kind of traits associated with autism that are uncomfortable for the individual that we'll explore and look at. But it's not saying like that the autism in and of itself is a problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense, because these individuals, the way they are, it doesn't mean they have to become more typical, right? It's more of a level of accepting in a loving way this person's nature.
Right. And I think too, you know, like when we're talking about recovery, I think it's really easy to kind of think about, well, this is the definition of recovery. This is what recovery should look like. And especially with a recovered clinician, like, okay, well, this is what my recovery looks like. And trying to think like, well, this is like the only way to do that. And so for our autistic clients, really looking at what do they see as recovery? What do they want their recovery to look like? You know, so for instance, a lot of times, you know, we'll see, you know, the literature on individuals who achieve sustained recovery, that, you know, the variety of foods, the number of foods that they can eat is one of the factors in that. And so it might be like, well, that's why we're pushing variety. But for this individual, the variety piece is not necessarily associated with the eating disorder. That's the stuff that predated it. Or really pushing the need for an individual to engage in social eating. And it's not so much fear of, you know, eating in front of people. It's not eating disorder related. It's the discomfort in social situations in general, or not wanting social connections there. So it's looking at, again, it's that assessment. If it's eating disorder, we need to push into it. If it's not, like, is the individual okay with that? Same thing for special interest with numbers. Like, you know, we might say, well, if you're still calorie counting, like, that's not recovery. Like, but if an individual has a special interest in numbers, they still might count calories. It just might be done so in a way that is supportive of recovery. Maybe there's a little bit more flexibility with what that number could be, or it's a number that's appropriate to sustain their needs. So it's not looking at, this looks like the eating disorder, we need to get rid of it across the board. It's, again, what kind of category does this fall in? And even when you're talking to autistic individuals who identify as being recovered, they still report a lot of food and eating related behaviors, but they will associate those with their autism and not the eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And again, it's going to look different, and we have to be okay with that and willing to work with that.
It almost sounds like setting boundaries between, like, the eating disorder and the autistic traits. It's like recognizing, you know, this special interest in numbers, for instance, this is authentically me. And so I'm going to keep this for myself, and it actually benefits me to do so from an autism perspective. Whereas from the eating disorder perspective, it's not beneficial to be over-focused or hyper-focused on numbers.
Right, right. And when you think about, like, special interests, those are ones that it tends to be more calming or comforting. And if you're looking at, for like a neurotypical client with an eating disorder, the counting calories is something that's related more to distress, or it's more of a kind of like a compulsive behavior related to the obsession around food. And so it's not necessarily calming and enjoyable in and of itself. Also looking at, like, the special interest in numbers, like, we're not going to just see that related to calorie counting. That's going to show up in a bunch of different areas too. There's some different things we can explore around, is that special interest, you know, truly just a special interest, or is this more of an eating disorder behavior?
That's really helpful to think about. Is this appearing in other areas of my life as well? And is it giving me a sense of comfort and joy as opposed to distress?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Very, very good stuff going on here. One thing that's challenging is the rigidity I see, like, with the co-occurrence between eating disorders and, you know, autistic traits. Like, rigidity around food can be so difficult for someone to heal when they have an eating disorder. It feels like there's a fine line, right, of, like, where it's helpful or hurtful to be rigid for someone. And how would you kind of expand on that through an autistic lens?
I think looking at, how is it impacting life as a whole? So more kind of quality of life, and is it interfering with goals? You know, so it might be that, hey, like, I want to be able to go on vacation with my family, but in order to go on vacation with my family, like, I have to be comfortable at eating at slightly different times, or I have to be comfortable eating out, or just able to do it. And so that might be an instance where there is the, like, okay, I have to work on the rigidity, or kind of that desire for the sameness in that area, versus, like, hey, every day, like, you know, you need to let go of a meal plan. Like, for some clients, the meal plan can be kind of the place where, hey, there's structure there and I like that, and that's where I want to stay. And so a lot of times you may have experienced this as well. There's a different level of attachment to shifting some of those behaviors around food or the timing of eating when it's more related to the autistic traits than just straight up kind of neurotypical experience of an eating disorder.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Another piece that seems to be, you know, part of, say, someone with an eating disorder is coming to terms with or wrapping their head around the fact that they might also be autistic, right? I think this is a phase I've seen folks in as well. The thought, I don't want to have another, quote, problem associated with me. I don't want to have another issue to manage. That seems to come up. And what do you have to say to individuals who might be like afraid to embrace their truth here in, you know, perhaps an autism diagnosis could be occurring or could be happening for them or helpful for them?
I start by exploring like the messaging they've received around autism in general. Like, at what age did they have a diagnosis, or how did parents talk about it? How do peers talk about it? Because a lot of that really influences, I think, whether an individual kind of connects to those traits and part of self as celebratory and like, this is what makes me me. And there's lots of wonderful things about that versus holding a lot of shame in that area. And I think a lot of times, unfortunately, what happens is parents will, you know, not disclose a diagnosis, or, you know, it won't come up until, you know, the individual is early adulthood. And then there tends to be a lot of shame, like, well, if this must have been some terrible thing, if my parents had to shield me from it, where, you know, the parents thought they were protecting the child. So looking at some of the messaging around it, I think exploring some of the strengths that are inherent with some of these traits as well is really positive. And then, you know, finding that community, finding different points of connection with, you know, other autistic individuals who are affirming and being able to connect with it in that way.
That's so helpful. I think there is so much stigma, or at least growing up, like back in the day, there was a lot more stigma that I think kids took on around this diagnosis. And thankfully now, you know, there are communities that can kind of break that down and change the narrative that someone might have within themselves about that diagnosis. Fabulous. Well, this has been extremely helpful. And I'm just really curious, you know, as we wrap up this conversation, I'd love to hear kind of what do you think would be the best next steps for folks who are connecting to what you're saying, who are thinking, you know, I have an eating disorder. You know, a lot of what Maggie is sharing today really speaks to me. What could be the best next step for someone who's in treatment for an eating disorder who might actually also be autistic?
I think, you know, one of the things could be talking to your treatment team about it and just starting the conversation around that. Another aspect, like if you don't have a treatment team yet, or, you know, you're not sure if you really are formally seeking out treatment for your eating disorder, would even just be doing some self-research. So Dr. Pookie Knight-Smith, she is autistic and she is in recovery from anorexia. And so she will often speak about kind of the overlap. And so even just seeking out different connection points for people who are autistic and hearing kind of like, okay, can I relate? Can I not relate? And going from there can be a good next step.
That's really great advice. And I love that you shared that resource. Speaking of resources, where can people go if they want to reach out to you or work with you throughout their recovery?
Yeah. So my email is mkleiss@elevatewellnesstherapy.com. And so email is usually like the best way to get me. I'm not super social media savvy, although that is something I'm trying to work on. So email for now is the best way.
Well, that is okay. Social media is not the most fun thing out there. So if you can have a practice without it, I'm actually kind of envious. But yes, Maggie, this has been a total delight. Thank you so much for being here. I think it was really eye-opening and interesting to learn about. I definitely learned a few new things along the way. So thank you so much. And I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking with you today.
Ah, you're so welcome. Have a great day.
You too.